That's the slides getting ready. Let me actually like to do another show poll. I love Taiya talk. That was really interesting. I wonder where is the light of the other end of tunnel. So I guess, yeah, we have been tied to agriculture so much, and I wonder if you are given a choice as a way to get off the homeless type of scenario, where is our home in the future? And I wonder whether you folks might have the ideas or opinions between, like, traditional agriculture college will be still our home, or engineering, or geosciences, or independent. So I kind of wondered about how many of you might think we should shift home to geosciences, for example. Huh, not too many. How about engineering? No? Why? And how about independent home of any kind? So looks, So looks like majority, if I guess right, would still like to stay in agriculture as a home. Or the alternative. So anyway, I thought that's something, it's interesting brought up to bring up. Well, this actually linked to my talk here in terms of how we might branch out, so to speak. And I also want to point out the title that I have there, highlighting the natural soils. And like, again, Kai and Danny was pointing out soil as a natural body. So that's what I'm trying to focus on in my talk here. Obviously, this the special symposium honoring Rin's career, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity to say a few words here. I put out the science citation index for the Soil Science Society of America Journal, just use that as an example. You put out the citation, and the top one, as you can imagine, is Rin's 1980 paper, cited near 4,000 as of May 3rd of this year when I was preparing an abstract. I checked that. And then also ranked number 4 is also Rin's 1976 paper with Peter. Impressive that he is really a top-sided soil scientist, I could say clearly. And this morning I just checked it, just see how the dynamic is going on. Rin's two highly cited papers, you can see that the numbers jumped just within half a year. I can use the mouse. All right. 80 paper, 249 more. And so basically indicating kind of snapshot, every month you have over 40 papers cite Rin's 1980 closed-formed formula. Same for 76, continue to be highly cited, although less, but still quite impressive, two per month, just in this past half a year. So that certainly is very much the great indicator of Rin's accomplishment in our community. Personally, I also like to briefly mention that Rin has been really inspirational and great supporter for what I have been trying to do in terms of hydropodology. And this is a snapshot of our party at my house during the first international conference of hydropodology last year. So apparently, Rin likes to drink Qingdao beer, right? But more than just drinking good wine or beer, Rin actually took some actions to help things. Like we had opportunity to work together on a quasi-vision paper on hydropodology. And so Rin contributed to these outputs in water resources that we put together a few years back. So Rin, I take this opportunity to say thank you for all your support and inspiration for all of us, not just myself. All right, so now get to my topic. Why I want to talk about preferential flow, as you have heard from many really stimulating talks this morning, just from this morning, that there are a lot of momentum still going on in our community and beyond. And again, from the Science Citation Index database, you kind of see this exponential increase of preferential flow. I'm just illustrating, not thorough literature search, but illustrating preferential flow tied to soil. Again, this is as of May 3rd when I was getting an abstract ready. And so you see that was already quite an impressive number. And then I also searched hydrophobicity as a specific form of preferential flow mechanism related to soil. So over 1,100. Now this morning I did quick check again, see the dynamics, impressive too. Well, before I get to that, I also want to point out the first international symposium on hydropotology was here in 1990. See, that time wasn't whole lot publications yet. 10 years later, in 2001, second one, you see the jump? Now, the third one is coming in 2012, I believe. And I'm guessing the numbers will be high up out of the chart. So that's why I only can use the corner. And so let's start. It's going to be shiny, I hope, more or less to attract more attention and visibility for what soil scientists contribute to broader environmental studies and ecosystem services. All right, here's the dynamics I was referring to. This morning, the same search, exact same database, same search. Jump to nearly 2,000. Same approach I follow, simple one. So let me see, in the past 6 months, there was about 50 papers per month pop up in the published peer-reviewed journal articles, not to mention other objects. And same for the hydrophobicity versus soil. On average, more than 12 papers per month popping up. So that's why my start hoping will make some sense in a few years. All right? So that brings to my message that I hope to convey to the audience here, that is how we might connect bridges between just S divisions, the soil science, soil physics, pathology in this particular case I'm highlighting, in terms of soil formation and evolution. So here, my use of preferential flow obviously is a very generic term that encompasses many different kinds, all right? So I'm not going into the details in the interest of time, but my point here is that mechanism-wise, they are all tied to heterogeneity, which is created by all sorts of possibilities that also could be tied to the soil farming processes and soil farming factors. And there's a positive feedback loop, and that's the important one to keep in mind why now you get to see more and more heterogeneity and then get to see more and more preferential flow and vice versa. Now, just to briefly illustrate, just in case some of you don't fear that you see the natural internal architecture that would make sense in terms of preferential flow. And this is a most productive agricultural soil in Pennsylvania called Hagerstown silkworm earthworm channels that clearly illustrated in this particular 30-meter long column, 10 centimeter diameter. Then I show you another soil which is on a ridge rather than in the valley. This is ridge, very physiographic region in Pennsylvania you're in. This is our critical zone observatory soil derived from shear and lots of rock fragments. And that's the natural architecture we are talking about. And so if we were to understand the flow and transport processes, we had to consider these natural architecture in terms of how that impacts the dynamics. So beyond the soil science familiar domain of vertical type of flow, the catchment hydrologists obviously focus more on the horizontal flow. And same story could be said of the all kinds of preferential flow dynamics going on related to heterogeneity. I'm briefly illustrating here this very obvious depression of focus to flow. And then, you know, this kind of subsurface that we may not see easily, but it's like a tile drain, but this is naturally formed mold hole drain in Africa. And if you look at whole catchment, like illustrated here, you really see some sort of pattern or organization that's dictated by, you know, topography, soil types, vegetation, and all that. And so if you to look at different scenarios, they are again tied to the heterogeneity. And I'm illustrating here, again briefly, our critical zone observatory in Shear Hills. One hill slope, you're going up the hill slope, you see the ground penetrating radar imaging of the subsurface heterogeneity in terms of refractance change as you go up the slope. And this is basically water restricting layer, more or less. But it's not consistent, or it's like a Swiss cheese. There are holes here and there. And that basically dictates how the flow will be like when the water runs down the hill slope and even vertically. All right, so that's kind of background that I'm trying to share before I get to this little bit more theoretical perspective that I'm trying to focus on. Again, I no, the time will not allow me to get into all the details. So I give you just a little bit taste of what I'm thinking about, and hopefully would make some sense. But I'm still working on it, so I'm certainly welcome your comments and feedbacks. And if you are interested in more details, I would be happy to share with you the manuscript that I have put together on the subject. So here I'm talking about three interconnected, more or less, theories. One is non-linear equilibrium thermodynamics. One is constructive theory, and then the other one is called theory of evolving networks. The basic message, without going into all the technical details, is that they are interconnected in some way, and they are shooting for certain convergence of the goal. That is, minimize energy dissipation. Yeah, find the least resistant path, and increase efficiency of the transfer of mass and energy. All right. So let's look at each of the three more closely. This slide basically shows the nonlinear thermodynamics I was talking about. And at the top is the famous Prigogine's dissipative structure type of theory, where looking at a system, you have the open system. The entropy in the system could be divided into two components. One is the internal increase of the entropy. That's always increasing over time, as dictated by the second law of the thermodynamics. But in the meantime, that's the reason why we are emphasizing open system, where the mass and energy exchange with the surrounding also carries the entropy exchange between the system and the environment. So depending on the in and out, the external component of the entropy of the total system could be net negative or net positive. All right, that will impact how the system itself, like the soil illustrated here, will be either more organized or more disorganized over time in terms of evolution physics. So here, as we know, soil in the natural landscape is an open system with constant mass energy input and output and all that. So the translating this Prigogine theory into our understanding of soil formation and evolution is that we kind of see two categories of processes involved, all right? One is what is labeled here as dissipated processes. That is kind of, in general, forming soil matrix. In this case, I'm specifically defining matrix as individual particles of soil, clay, sand, and all that, just like individual molecules of water, gas. So these processes lead to smaller units or more and more disorganized system, all right? So dissipation leads to things like decomposition of organic matter, the structure degradation and dispersion. We heard dispersion quite a bit this morning. And also erosion, weathering, and microbial respiration, all these consuming energy dissipated back to the system inside and around it and forming these smaller units. And then the other opposite is called organizing processes, where you do see forming more and more organized units within the system, where you do have better structured soil profile developed over time, aggregation, horizontation, and so on and so forth. So this kind of partitioning, we call dual partition of paragenesis, leads to basically different architecture in the soil, as well as the fluxes, both these dissipated and organizing processes. We have fluxes into the environments, all right? So influencing the life systems as well as landscape evolution. And they work feedback to the soil continued evolution over time. So if you look at, this is just a quick example of soil profile changing from the young soil to the more developed, matured soil profile over time, you basically would expect that the soil matrix entropy inside the system will increase over time. But the interesting part is that the organization of the soil system will lead to decreased entropy of soil structure. And so overall, the net effect as we will expect in terms of soil formation, is going to lead to net decrease of the overall system entropy. And that basically reflects these kind of processes we all would expect. Accumulated energy consumption and more water passing through the profile, and therefore leading to more organization as well as heterogeneity. Now, I have to differentiate the term heterogeneity and randomness. Heterogeneity here, I mean, is an organized, all right? Randomness is disordered or disorganized. So that's a differentiation I'm emphasizing. And that will lead to different kinds of preferential flow, either vertical, lateral, or both. The constructive theory is actually developed by Bijan at Duke University. He is actually in mechanical engineering. I'm not sure whether there's a coincidence or not. Right now, you're in mechanical engineering department. So anyway, the theory is summarized in the top statement. Basically, it says that for a finite size flow system to persist over time or to survive over evolution, it must evolve in such a way that it will provide easier flow access for the current to pass through the system, all right? That could be energy, could be mass. And so this kind of flow tendency basically calls for at least the two flow regimes, as we have heard, two domains, you know, passive type of flow and preferential type of flow. Again, giving the details, explaining the theory. There's three principles behind this theory that I was thinking I could briefly mention to you, illustrate in this chart. The vertical is basically the freedom to move or to change. That is basically the time factor. The axis is basically the indication of performance, either the conductivity or reverse of it, the resistance of the flow system. And then this axis indicate the architecture of the system, where you have either the more open flow pathways or less. And there's an interesting parameter called swellness, which is the ratio between the global length scale external one versus the internal one. So that's called swellness, the compactness of the soil system or anything that flows. All right. So the three principles, briefly, is survival by increasing flow performance. So that's indicated by this curve, all right, towards equilibrium, where you do have a as the more pore space open up for flow, the resistance to the flow decreases. It's a negative slope, all right? The second is survival by increasing flow territory. That is, once you reach a certain limit of the material total porosity, you have to invade into the surrounding environments. So you end up with this curve, oops, that is giving you the positive slope. And then the third one is, as you run into further limitation constrained by the environmental condition you are in, you cannot expand further in terms of territory, then you have to organize yourself inside, so you basically survive by increasing the swellness of the system, where that is indicated by this dash curve. So I can apply that principle to the understanding of the earlier slide I showed you, the soil evolution. Again, it looks like I'm running out of time, so I won't get into further details. But basically, if you think about how rocks weathered, evolved, and developed into different stages of soil types, you are basically talking about the opening up, the pore space, and then how soil reorganized itself over time. And I can apply the three principles to explain that process, and also using some indicators, as I highlighted in the table, to suggest that as the soil developed, you're talking about opening up more space for flow, and so you have, for example, K-sect in the surface continue to increase over time, but as you hit to certain peak level, then you start to see the turn of the growth, where you see the subsurface, which is kind of easiest part for compaction, for some reason, which I won't get into the details, that they will start to show the decreased K-sect in the middle part of the profile, more or less. Well, the third theory is hopefully is more straightforward, which I again briefly mentioned. Networks is everywhere, as I illustrated here, which are driven by the major driving forces of soil formation, climate and organisms, all right, of different kinds. And there's evolving network theory in the literature these days, very hot, And basically saying three aspects that I'm highlighting here. One is the network is a growth process. Second is that the connection of network has preference, all right? Preferential attachment in terms of how the networks connect and disconnect and evolve over time. And also the function or dynamics of the network is inseparably linked to the topology of the network at both local and global scales. They are two-way communications involved. So this is just an illustration from my postdoc PhD work in New Zealand showing how the subsurface Hillsdorf scale of network type of flow was observed. This is real data, all right? So this is basically the end of my talk. To summarize the three theories that I have talked about, and I want to emphasize, though, there are controversies and remaining challenges to be resolved for each of the three theories. So I'm not saying that they are all set and we had to 100% embrace, but they are thought-provoking and they offer opportunities for further understanding of the complexity in our dynamic soil systems in nature. And one of that is the time factor we had to emphasize more, that is evolution physics type of stuff. And the green stuff basically highlighted to what I mentioned earlier in terms of three general goals of this kind of evolution. So my last point is, where is the path for us to develop a possible preferential flow theory? And with that, I give you these slides thinking that maybe we should think about how to electrify ourselves to take off for developing some kind of preferential flow theory. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Henry. We are going to hold questions for the general discussion because we are running quite late. For those of you who came later, just an announcement, Peter Ratz is not here, so we are going to have only one more presentation, and that is by Keith Bristow from Australia.